Well, as I told you earlier, one of the big challenges for people like myself who are writing about the Copts is how do you convey, for example, what we just heard from Sarah. For us it's all, you know, yeah, why not? Why, you know, you can put your desire in the altar and you believe when someone prays with you over this and what is picked, you do that. But there's a lot of Christians even out there who don't believe that, especially when they're Western. They find that very hard to accept. And so the big struggle and the big challenge is, how do you transmit a story like the story of Mother Irene to the world? How do you have to find a frame, because you want to do justice to what she meant to the Copts, but also to the fact that this is not just a myth, that this is a reality, and that this was a sincere person and a very smart person, a very intelligent person who was operating with the grace and with a very special grace of God. And because what we often see, if you think about myths, a myth is often a unified account of the past. And that story then becomes unifying for us in the future and in the now. So you take a story from the past and you somehow boil it down to certain elements. And that is what you, for example, see in many of the icons that we've been looking at. But I think you cannot do that with someone like Umina Irene, because what her message was a message for the 20th and the 21st century. And it is a message that continues. And it is a unifying message. Who of you here has never heard of Mother Irene? I see only one hand, and you are forgiven because you're not a Copt, I think. Right? And there is not one Copt who has not heard of her, right? Not one. Because her fame grew during her life. And now I have to put this, I'm not sure the computer was put on the side. I have to put it back, if you don't mind. Okay. What I suggest we do is that we let Umina Irene speak for herself as much as we can, and in a way I more or less interpret her actions. And I must say, it is not easy. Here again, we have the insider-outsider issue. If you read my book carefully, you will see that I write that she became the abbess, the head of the convent at the age of 16. And I always thought that was very young. And one day I asked her myself, I said, is it true that you became the abbess at the age of 16? Now, maybe my Arabic was so poor that she had no idea what I was saying, but she did not deny it. She did not say, no, I was 26. That's what I know now. She was 26, right? But the problem is, there is also something going on of a secret. She did not want to share things with the world, and not even with me. Obviously an outsider, obviously a foreigner, because, you know, you never know what people do with your information. And so it is very important, if we think about people of that type of life, of an obviously very inspired, very blessed, holy life. Those people are, on the one side, vessels, just regular human beings. But on the other side, they have a model function. And they know that. And she knew that. She knew she had a model function. And to process that model function was part of her life. As we know, she never would allow people to film her in public during the feast of the martyrdom of Abu Sufyan in December. She would come out as there was the mulet in the convent, and I remember seeing her the first time. You would see only her back on the camera. You would not see Umina Irene's face. She did not want people to make pictures of her, to make films of her. She did not want those to start a life of their own. And also, if we now put this in a more theoretical frame, if we read about martyrs and if we read about people from the past who knew that their story was going to be retold by the generations after them. And for example, the story of Perpetua, Saint Perpetua, has been researched by, and those of you who studied this this kind of material, by Elizabeth Castelli. And she has more or less analyzed how Saint Perpetua wrote her diary with in mind the people who would read it after she would have died the death of a martyr. Because she knew the story goes on, and she herself had to tell it. It was very important that she herself told people how she changed from an upper-class woman into a person of whom all the layers were stripped away of what we call humanity, and who gave her life in full obedience to God. And we have there, you know, we have all kinds of theories. Some of you might have heard of Foucault, who writes about that, and he calls that technologies of the self. How in building your own image, letter writing is very important. Writing about yourself. And so we look at Umina Irini's life, Mother Irini's life, and we somehow see now in retrospect how she proceeded in building up her image by not allowing people to take pictures of her, and I always honor that. I had a picture of her when just after publishing the book, a monk gave me a picture of her when she was still in her 20s, and I just never used it, because, you know, you have to honor that. As someone from the outside, you cannot break that covenant. That is her wish, and it is, and I have the picture, and it was a lovely picture, and I was dying to publish it, but I couldn't. But also, when we look at her life now, you see the struggle in her, how she transformed from a girl who was from a family, born in from a family in Girga, a very, very devout family, a quite middle-class family, how she then moved into becoming what she is now to us, a saintly model, someone who is a model for all Copts and for all non-Copts who are willing to learn about her life. And to me, as a Christian, as a believer, and maybe not even as a Christian, I mean, I think if I were a devout Hindu or Buddhist, it would just as be important to say, well, this is a living example of how God is present in the world. And that is a very important message that always has to be spread in a time. You know, we are in an economic crisis. Many people feel very desperate. And so this is a very important message that never, never should disappear. And so we have to highlight this message. And so when I look at Irini's life, then I see how she kept a very strict control over her heritage and her image. And one example is this picture. I don't know if any of you recognize it, how she is being portrayed, looking with her hand here. Do you see it? Do you immediately recognize that as being Irini? Those of you who have seen pictures of Irini? Who says I did not recognize that at all? You didn't yet? Okay, that's okay. Because as time goes on, when you see this picture, especially the one in the background, you will recognize that as being Mother Irini. You will see it from afar, you won't see her face, and you will know this is Mother Irini. And in some places, she's holding a white flower. And I cannot, for the life of me, remember the name of the flower, neither in Arabic, nor in Dutch, nor in English. But that flower, the nuns told me, was a very important symbol because it was the first harvest of flowers in Sidi Kir. That picture was taken when the first flowers in Sidi Kir were ready to be harvested and given away or used in the church or used for the liturgy and so forth and so forth. So how did she transmit her image? She transmitted it through the nuns. Her lessons to the nuns. She was always teaching her nuns. She also transmitted it through the public meetings. And we know about the many public meetings. As I said, the mulit of Abu Sifain, of St. Mercurius. Then she would come out and tell about the many, many miracles that had been that had happened in the convent through the intercession of Saint Abu Sufyan. And now, but now we have an explosion of how she is transmitting her ideas. We have writings by the nuns, we have the famous video. Have you all seen the movie? Have you all seen the movie of Omena Irene? But we have also the messages that she put in the convent. And first, when I first came to the convent, you had to keep hammering on the door till finally someone would open it. And it was very difficult to get in. You could only get in on the Fridays that were the visiting days. Now I have noticed, and maybe that is just my impression, but that it is much more open. It is much more open because the convent now has a message to the world and a message to the Copt. And so when you think about the vision, the first one was for the nuns in the convent, which started right in 1962, after she had been consecrated as the Mother Superior, where there's a famous story of how she opened the church of Saint Abu Sufyan. Before that, the nuns had to go out of the convent to go to the church in Old Cairo, but now there was this sick old nun who couldn't walk very well and who was blind, and Omena Irene felt sensitive to the nun's needs and said, we need a church. And she asked Amba Kyrillos, and here's Amba Kyrillos again, who was allowing her to execute her vision, to put in place her ideas. And she said, we really need our own church. And he said, you go ahead, do this. And then the church of Abu Sufyan was built, or it was there, but it was improved, and it was the area in the convent was made into a church. And so while she was doing that, she infused her work with a very strong gender message, a very strong pro-women message. And for example, now I found it very interesting when I came into the convent how her picture is now there, and of course the picture of any superior who has passed away is hanging on the wall, but the way it is presented, and maybe you don't think anything about that, but I found it very interesting, because here is Omena Irene, there is the Virgin Mary, and on the other side is His Holiness Patriarch Shenouda III, and they're all on the same level. And so here we're back to this picture of the church. This is from the church of St. Abu Sufyan. And here are, just to remind you, I put in again the picture of the two female saints, and I'm coming back to that in one moment. Because one of the main lessons that she wanted to go out, as I told you, was cleanliness. Well, it's not a bunch of silly women living here. No, these women know what they're doing. They keep their bodies clean, their minds clean, and the place clean. And that's why I took this picture of the lovely meal that you always get offered when you come till today to the convent, and how beautifully it's put out. Do you see how the cheese is being decorated? Are there many places in Egypt where they decorate the cheese? Now I ask you. Right? Exactly. I don't want to insult the Egyptians, but it is there. And look how the kebab is nicely put on the, you know, maybe you think, so what? But this is not normal, I tell you. This is beautiful. And so this is, you know, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure for all the senses to be there and to see this. So I was moved to take a picture. And again, here's the convent. You know, everything looks beautiful, and it is a place to rest and a place to find refuge. And this is, again, part of the garden of the convent's farm in Sidi Kreer. You see, it's a place where you can go, where you can somehow find yourself. It's also a place for women, where women can go and reflect, and where they can talk to other women religious specialists. A nun is a religious specialist. And where you can find spiritual counseling and spiritual, where you can find hope, and where you can also find the confirmation that God works, because the fact that these buildings are there now is in a way a confirmation of God's work in the world. And so I remember, for example, and this is again the picture of the church in Sidi Kriya, where, and this is again, and I'll come back to this for me in a minute, but for example, at one point, I left Egypt in 1990, beginning of the first Gulf War. And then I went to Indonesia. For many, many years, I did not go back, because Indonesia and Egypt are very far apart. And when I went back again, I noticed that in the convent, I didn't go back to the convent right away, because I remembered how difficult it was to come in. But when I finally felt I should go back to see how the nuns were doing, they showed me a new large hall for the family of the nuns. Has any of you seen that hall? A very large space which was built specially for visitors. And now in retrospect, I realize that that large space was made also with in mind the day that Irini would not be with us any longer, and many, many would visit the convent and would need to be seated somewhere. And it was in that space that the nuns invited me, and they said, please come tonight, because tonight the family of the nuns is, the families of the nuns are coming. And that evening, I was the first time I realized how powerful the influence of Mother Irini was. Because there were, of the families of the nuns, there was everything possible. There were monks, there were priests, there were brothers, fathers, there were sisters, mothers, and so forth. And everybody sat patiently, spellbound, listening to her talking. And then, one by one, she blessed everybody in the room. She blessed them all by laying on their hands, on their head, and saying a little prayer for them. And at that point, I realized the importance of image, the image you have. It wasn't the blessing, but how she then left. Because, again, a person like that cannot allow themselves to be attacked, to be, you know, let's say, surrounded like a pop star. That is not how you can live when you live this kind of life. And she had an elevator. Any of you has ever seen the elevator inside the convent? Who has seen the elevator? It is an elevator which was made specially for her as she got weaker and sicker, because we know she suffered a lot. She was very sick all through her career as a nun, and it was really considered a miracle that she stayed with us so long. So there was this elevator that brought her down from her room, and it is built on the outside of the building, and in it, behind it, is a very large picture of the Virgin Mary. And so, full of dignity, she walked to the elevator, and she went up, and as she went up, she waved at us. And I thought, this moment in life I will never forget, as old as I get. Because the way she waved at us was like, I'm blessing you one more time, and I'm retreating now, if you don't mind, and one day I will have to retreat for good. Now, so in this large building, in this large community hall, is this mosaic. It was made in that community hall. Again, the assertion that this was where the Holy Family stayed. But on the way to the community hall, and now on the way to her grave, is this picture of Christ. And it refers to John 7, verse 38. And I'm not sure if you can read it. Yeah, you can read the Arabic, right? Can I try? من آمن بكما قال الكتاب. قال الكتاب is not there. It's the point. تجري من بطني أنهار ماء حي. Thank you. I want to learn my Arabic again. It's pushed away by Indonesian. But it is really powerful. He that believes on me, out of his belly shall flow rivers of living water. That was one of the last messages. The living water that comes to all those who believe. And so everyone going to a grave passes this picture. And here is the entrance to a grave. And where, and I know, it's Atef Isaac. Is he here? because one of you wrote me an email and said, I read the announcement for today, and he was afraid that I was going to talk about Umina Irini as if she were dead. And he said, I want to tell you that as a cop, I believe that she is not dead, but that she is everlasting with the Lord. Of course, the death of a saintly person, as we know, is celebrated, for they entered into the eternal life. And so this is where her grave is. This is in a special room, it's a grave, and it just has a beautiful cover, and it is a place of consolation, a place where people get not only consolation, where they can get courage, and where they can feel at home. The children are sitting on the tomb, and that was allowed. And you see here is a little bit, and around it are the pictures of Umina Irini. And in the corner, and I love this picture. Do you see what's in the corner? What's in the plastic bag? The prayer requests. In the plastic bag there are the prayer requests, so that the Holy Mother will pray for those in need. And I put a request in there as well, with a whole list of everybody I know who's sick. And I truly believe that she prayed for them. So she really infused the category of gender with a new identity for women, a new agency for women, a new empowerment for women that is appropriate for the 21st century. And that is also appropriate for women, Coptic women, growing up in the United States. And one of the ways that she did that was by producing books. You must have seen the many books the convent has produced about the lives of the saints. They started to research all possible lives of the saints. And also, they added to that lives of saints who are not Coptic. I don't know if you recognize these pictures, but these are saints that are from the Russian Orthodox Church. You know, the women and the monks, and in this case the nuns who survived the communist regimes, or who did not give up, or who were martyred during the communist era in Russia. And so this visual culture is also becoming very present in books. And this is just, you see, this is a photo of the book of the shop in Deir Abu Safain. On the top level you see all the books of the patron saint, and then under there are the books of the women. So in a way, with great respect, even the books were placed, but they are there, and they're now together. And people, as I told you, there's a covenant of seeing going on, and so people are getting used to seeing women among these in these kind of publications. So passive icons tell a story. They seem passive, but they tell a story. Especially, and when we have the literature, we can fill in that story. We can learn more about the saints, and we can somehow start to imagine what these lives meant. And so these lives become real to us, rather than people who did fantastic things that none of us can any time do nowadays. Suddenly we see the struggle of people. We see what it meant to live a certain life, live in a certain place, live under a certain pressure. It becomes real. And we see that, you know, nothing has changed in humanity. People suffer wherever they are. And they have to try to find ways to survive and to be brave. And so, now I'm coming back to the icon of Barbara, St. Barbara, because that is what she put in the church. But then, of course, the life of St. Barbara is described in one of those books. Because both St. Barbara and St. Marina are saints that come from wealthy backgrounds, and they were martyred in the early Christian period. But in both cases, their devotion awoke such strong compassion among those who witnessed their death that they inspired others to join them in death voluntarily. And if you look at the... I have to go back here for a minute. If you look at the icon of St. Barbara, you see there, in the background, the image of another person, And I understand that that was Juliana. I got them from the book, who was beheaded at the same time because she was so inspired by St. Barbara's River. And Marina, St. Marina, stands on top of the devil, and you see that the devil is depicted as a dragon with a human face, and this gives a very clear statement. And Marina also, according to the story, the executioner was so inspired by her example that he converted to Christianity and was also ready to be martyred. So the statement is very clear, although it's not so obvious at first sight. It is that virgins, women, were as important to the growth of the Christian faith as men were. They were there, and they suffered equally. And they were as courageous and as tenacious as men. And so, as I told you, this these themes are repeated all over the other places, the other churches, and so forth, in Deir Abu Sufayn. Now, let me see where I am here before I get lost in my own writings. So we see that what I told you about earlier, the covenant of seeing, it's not broken, but it's continued and it's expanded. Yeah, we see these women become real women. We see them become real figures, although the representation is more or less static and in certain forms. As we think about their stories, they become real. And we also realize the social and the political and the spiritual repercussions they could evoke, the events they could evoke, that they had influence, although we never thought about it in that way. But the apotheosis, or the ultimate example of Irene's, Mother Irene's visual testament, is in the Church of the Virgin Mary, Knesset al-Adra, which is in the garden of the convent. Any of you has been in that church? Yeah? Isn't it a marvelous church? It is a wonderful church. And we know that it was built in 1968. It was consecrated in 1968. After, in 1964, Omina Irini had a vision of the Virgin Mary in the garden, telling her that this was the place where she had rested during the flight to Egypt. And this is, to me, you know, as someone from Holland, this kind of mind-boggling. Then she forgot about the vision for a while. So, whoa, the Virgin Mary appears to you and then you forget about it? How can that? You know, to me that's very strange, but then kind of the vision kind of, you know, fell away, and then the place, there was a shed in the garden to store tools, and then suddenly Amba Kyrillos had a vision from the Virgin Mary and phoned her and said, really, this has to be a church. We have to be serious here. And so the church was consecrated on March 9, in 68, and the Virgin gave a sign that her presence in the garden was true through this fresco. And we all know the story of the fresco, that it was, what do you call it, oozing, leaking, I don't know what verb to use here, but out of it came the Holy Chrism. And Amba Kyrillos caught it because it could not touch the floor, of course. It was the holy oil. Now, since 1989, this church has been enlarged. It was a small chapel at first. It has been enlarged, and in 2004 and 2007 it was renovated. And until today, it is not finished yet. The nuns have not finished decorating it. And so they're still working on painting the icons and decorating window panes. And in doing this, they are following Omena Irene's exact, precise directions. She told them what to paint, who should paint it, and what should be on those icons. And so the first part of the church is that it is a testimony to the life of the Virgin Mary. It has, in the glass windows and in the icons, it portrays the Virgin's life. Here is the Annunciation. Here is the Dormition. Here we have the visit of the three kings. And then here we have the presentation of the temple in the temple, where with Simeon's and Saint Anna's prophecies, where you know the now your servant, Lord, your servant can depart in peace, according to your word. For my eyes have seen your salvation. And here we have the flight to Egypt, of course. And then we have some other themes that you sometimes see in churches, but not that often. Do we have any idea what this is? What? Simeon? Right, exactly. How do you know? The eye, right? You see someone with one eye and you know, aha, this is the miracle of the moving of the mountain of Mokattam. And this one you know better than I do, because I didn't know this feast. What is this one? What? I don't hear you. Yeah, exactly. Matthias in jail. Do you call it Al-Adra Halat Al-Hadid? Something like that? Yeah. If we don't have it, I don't know. We don't have that feast at all. So, she, you know, where she dissolved the iron, and the Apostle Matthias, the 13th Apostle, could come from out of church. And as we know, it was also the feast of the commemoration of this event, was also, according to the tradition, the day that the first church in the name of the Virgin Mary was built in Philippi. And there are other very interesting new themes in the church. This is, of course, the wedding of Cana. The wedding of Cana, where, according to John 2, verse 1 to 12, symbolized that the kingdom of God will spread beyond Judea. And it was the first visible public miracle of Jesus. And around this icon, there are still many openings. So I really wonder if when we come back, we see that all the seven first miracles, grand miracles of Jesus will be there. But you see, the chapel is full of symbolism and full of very strong messages. I mean, you could go to that chapel and just bring your Bible and really go through many, many very important events in Christianity. And one other icon, which I couldn't find the picture in my files, but there is also the icon of Ambarues, the anchorite Ambarues. And, you know, he was very well known for his long fast and his clairvoyance. And Omina Irini passed away on the same day as he passed away. And I'm sure that she did not plan that icon, but I'm not sure. The nuns didn't want to tell me, so maybe Amba Serapion can ask. They will tell you for sure. You're a bishop, you know. If she maybe left behind the message, put the icon of whoever's day it is that I pass away on. But it is very, very strong symbolism, because you know that Ambarues' body is in the church, which in the Coptic Patriarchate, which is the central place of the of all Copts in the whole world. It's the central unit where everybody looks at, where the patriarch lives, and where the big cathedral is. And so the coincidence of the day must be accidental, unless she knew what day she was going to die. I don't know. But this icon of Ambarues tells the story of connection and equality in spiritual gifts, and the acknowledgement that the convent and the patriarchate, and now I ask forgiveness if I insult anybody, are very closely related on a spiritual level. And then the rest of the church is decorated with icons of women. Now this is the icon of Saint Anna Simone, and this is Saint Eugenia, or Eugenia, I'm not sure how you pronounce it here. Eugenia? And both
both women guided men and women as heads of monastic communities. Anna Simone was the daughter of a king, and she fled the palace to become a low servant in a convent. And you see that her royal clothes are on the chair next to her. And after suffering much abuse and ridicule from her fellow nuns, she left for the wilderness and became the spiritual head of 400 monks. Eugenia, she is, as you see, she is wearing the monk's cap. And she was originally in a male disguise and became the head of a monastic community for men. Forced by allegations of sexual impropriety, she revealed her true identity and went on to lead a community of virgins. Now, on the other side of this wall, so this is on one wall, now on the other side, we have the male founders of monasticism. We have Saint Anthony Antonius, we have Abba Homius, we have Abba Macarius, and we have Abba Shenouda. And so those are opposite each other. They're opposite each other. And again, they're on the same level. And then there is a special icon of Saint Syncletica, the female desert mother, the desert mother, who was a spiritual guide to women and girls, and whose teachings have come down to us through the sayings of the mothers and the fathers. And of course, there is also the icon of Saint Irene, who at a young age could discern her calling, her high calling, and as a virgin and as a martyr, and whose name Irene bears. So what I am saying is that by reading all these different pictures and by reading all these different representations and presentations and all these different lessons, we see a legacy developing, a legacy which is very strong, a legacy which can last for, let's say, the ages, which will be transmitted by people like yourself, and I'm now looking at that side because that's where many of the high schoolers are sitting, right? You will give this on to your children and to your grandchildren. And as time will pass, maybe more things will become, more information will become available to us. And we haven't heard the last word yet, and not the last book has been produced yet. There's going to be more and more, and it will build up. And it is up to us to put this in a frame, to transmit this, and to make that people take it seriously, that people see this as something important, not as something just for the Copts, just happening in Egypt, just happening in a remote convent, but something which is a sign for the ages, for all people, whether they're Christians or not Christians. And but coming back to the visual culture, Irene's activities and Irene's life has very far-reaching consequences for how the Coptic visual culture is changing. Because here we have, as you see, an exhibition or a rack full of videos, and there is the video of Mother Irene next to videos of holy monks and holy fathers. And here we have a picture of Mother Irene right next to the picture of His Holiness, Patriarch Shenouda. And here we have Mother Irene, and that's why I say that the picture of her looking sideways with her veil folded in a certain way, that will be something you will start to recognize. Here she is, right together on a clock with other clocks, portraying Amba Kyrillos. And before I end and tell you what this is, I hope I'm not even sure how much time I had now. I think we wanted to end this at like 4:45. Okay. Let me read for you something that I wrote as a little conclusion to an article I just handed in for a book with several articles on the Coptic Church, and you know, her legacy conveys a very strong statement about the opportunities for women, the agency of women, and the capacities of women. Images in all the buildings she constructed testify of equality in the spiritual struggle of women and men. Women cannot reach for official church positions, but as the stories of Saints Anna Simone and Eugenia show, once the conventions with regards to gender fall away, their pursuits of asceticism and prayer are not only equal to those of male ascetics, but fully acceptable to their fellow Christians. And so the convent has become a tribute to the power of women, the potential power of women. Now, and as I say, while Irene herself did not write down her memoirs for fear of being idolized while she was still alive, she provided detailed instructions and remained in full control of her legacy that she wished to leave behind, because following the tradition of the early martyrs and the saints, this legacy is not for herself. It is for the glory of God, and it is for the benefit of the community and of the believers and of those living the monastic calling, which we heard from Sarah is not easy. 3 days was hard enough, right? Imagine 30 years, 40 years. It is a very high and very difficult calling. And so, and she must have understood the power of visual expressions for the Coptic memory. She must, you know, we know, as we talked about earlier, the love of the Copts for pictures, for icons, and the expression of many themes through the visual. And she understood that, and she understood what it did, what it could do, and what she could reach for. And she also understood that her message should not be limited to words, but also should be translated into pictures. And I end with this picture. Has any of you ever seen this poster? Have you? So this is a poster that shows all the saints that people can remember in the Coptic. You see, the top couldn't even fit on the picture, so I only have half the poster here. And when you look in the, when you go to the lower lines, you start to see the people that lived in the era where photography came into existence. You know, by the 18th, 19th century, you see people being portrayed. So you see, for example, Amba Abraham, you see him. I know it's tiny, it's difficult seeing. I have no pointer, unfortunately. But you start to see people that were real people in, let's say, the modern age, starting from the 19th century. There is Umina Irini at the very end of the list. She is there, and with her are two other nuns. And so this is what I mean. The culture is changing, whether we like it or not. And when we see a picture like this 50 years from now, who knows how many women will be on it. Thank you very much.